From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Iran hosted a Holocaust conference this week to challenge whether the Holocaust really happened. On today's Fresh Air, the stories of Arabs who helped rescue Jews from the Holocaust. We talk with Robert Satloff about his new book, Among the Righteous, Lost Stories from the Holocaust's Long Reach into Arab Lands. The book also tells how the German Nazis, the Italian fascists, and the French Vichyists persecuted Jews in Arab lands and laid the foundation for their eventual extermination. Also, we remember the actor Peter Boyle. He died this week at the age of 71. He was best known for his roles in Joe, Young Frankenstein, Taxi Driver, and of course, Everybody Loves Raymond. We'll listen back to an interview with him. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, Iran hosted a conference on the Holocaust to challenge whether the Holocaust really happened. The Holocaust deniers and white supremacists were welcomed to the conference by President Ahmadinejad. My guest Robert Satloff has written a new book about the Holocaust's reach into Arab lands. It tells the story of how the German Nazis, Italian fascists, and French Vichyists applied some of the same anti-Semitic methods in North Africa that were used against Jews in Europe. The book also tells the lost stories of Arabs who protected and rescued Jews. It's called Among the Righteous. Satloff is executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Robert Satloff, welcome to Fresh Air. Is Holocaust denial part of your reason for writing your new book?
It's actually the principal reason why I first started writing my book, which was a recognition that Holocaust denial is really the tip of the iceberg which separates the great cultural divide between many aspects of Arab and Muslim culture and our own. And I tried to come up with a way to access, a way for Arabs to access this so that they wouldn't be subject to the horrible spewing of the deniers. Most Arabs, I find, actually are not deniers as much as ignorant of the events of World War II, of the Holocaust. And so I wrote this book to try to find a way for them to access it in a language and in a history and a context which would make sense.
Part of what you wanted to do with your research was to find stories of Arabs who helped save Jews during the Holocaust. Why was that your angle?
Well, I very early tried to come up with a hopeful and positive and constructive way to talk with Arabs of goodwill about the Holocaust. And the first conclusion I reached is that I should try to make it an Arab story, and not just an Arab story, but perhaps a story about which Arabs could identify. An Arab who saved a Jew, if you accept and celebrate the heroism of an Arab who saved a Jew, then you have to accept the context that there was something to save that Jew from. And so in some way, I hoped that I could use this as a way to lance the boil, as it were, of some of the denial that exists in these societies.
Before we get to some of the stories you uncovered, let's just look at the map of Northern Africa during World War II. Which parts of Northern Africa were controlled by fascist Nazis or the Vichy government of France, which was collaborating with Germany after the invasion of France?
Well, the first observation is that most Arab countries were under European domination, under European colonialism. You had in North Africa, for example, France governing Algeria as a colony and governing Morocco and Tunisia as protectorates. They had their own titular monarchs, the Sultan in Morocco and the Bey in Tunis, but they were under French control. Libya was an Italian colony. Then Germany came to these lands directly in terms of their own occupation only in one Arab country, and that's Tunisia, for a very important six-month period in 42 and 43. Other Arab countries had their touch with European Axis powers. Syria and Lebanon, for example, were under Vichy control, but only for a brief period of time. When one speaks principally about the Holocaust's long reach into this land, into Arab lands, one is speaking mainly about the North African experience, where Germany, Vichy France, and the Italian fascists were in control from summer of 1940, until the spring, until May, certainly in Tunisia, until spring of 1943.
There were no death camps in Northern Africa, but there were labor camps. What did you learn about those labor camps?
Yes, this is one aspect of the story that, you know, I had no idea existed. There were over 100 slave and forced labor camps in Arab lands. 100 spread out from Morocco on the west through Libya on the east. Now, these were called concentration camps by the French and by the Germans who established them. And matter of fact, what we tend to forget is the first concentration camps ever liberated by the Allies were these, the ones in Arab lands in 1942. There were torture camps, what the French themselves called punishment camps. Sometimes these were for Jews in local Arab lands, the ones in Tunisia especially, and in Libya, and in some parts of Algeria. Sometimes thousands of Jews were deported from Europe to serve in slave labor camps in the Sahara, in Arab lands. So there's a mix of Jews, European Jews, Jews from Arab lands who suffered, but the total number is over 100 that have now been recognized by the German government. One of the small measures of pride, actually it's a great measure of pride, my contribution was modest, one of the great measures of pride from my research was to help contribute to this effort through some of my findings that convinced the German government to provide compensation to some of the Jewish survivors of these camps.
You know, you point out that there were labor camps in northern Africa, even though they were not death camps. I was not aware of that. At the same time, I've seen the movie Casablanca a lot. You point out a scene in Casablanca in which labor camps are referred to that I have to say went right past my attention every time I've seen it. Do you want to describe that scene?
It went past my attention the first dozen times I saw the movie, too, until it finally dawned on me as I was watching it for the umpteenth time that Major Strasser warns Ilse that it would be better for her husband to give himself up and go back to Paris, or else, he says, I will put him in a concentration camp here. And the critical word is here. He meant a concentration camp in Morocco. And, I mean, there's a lot of technical flaws in Casablanca, but that one was absolutely right. And one has to remember, Casablanca actually came out in December 42, only 1 month after the Allied invasion of North Africa, and they knew it, and they understood it, and this was well known at the time. And that's really, really why I subtitle my book Lost Stories, not Unknown Stories, because there was a time when people knew about these and talked about them.
Now, you described some of the laws that were put into effect in North African countries during World War II that limited the rights of Jews, stripped some Jews of their citizenship. You say that a lot of Jews in that part of the world were already second-class citizens?
Well, I think it's very important to understand the relationship between Jews and Arabs in Arab countries historically. It is absolutely true that you were better off being a Jew living in an Arab or Muslim land historically than being a Jew being born in a Christian land. Jews of Christian lands suffered the Inquisition, being burned at the stake, the pogroms, the massacre of York. One never had any of that in Arab lands, a very different experience. So relatively, you were better off in Arab and Muslim lands. Objectively speaking, life for Jews in Arab lands wasn't itself a rose garden. You were a dhimmi. You were, which is a dhimmi is a Muslim religious term which referred to non-Muslim people of the book, non-Muslim believers who had a different rank, a different status in society than Muslims themselves. You paid special taxes. You were subject to special laws, special restrictions on where you could live, what you could do as an occupation. It was difficult, sometimes very difficult. So relative to the Jews of Christendom, you were much better off. Of course, you didn't know that if you only grew up and lived in these countries.
My guest is Robert Satloff, author of Among the Righteous. He's also the executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Satloff, and he's the author of the new book, Among the Righteous, Lost Stories from the Holocaust's Long Reach into Arab Lands. Let's get to some of the stories that you uncovered about Arabs who helped protect or save Jews during World War II in Arab lands. First of all, you say that there were Arab guards in camps who intentionally disobeyed orders to help protect Jews.
Well, there are some testimonies from some Jewish survivors of these camps that at times the torture or the orders coming from the fascist commandants, usually French legionnaires, were so egregious, so inhumane, that some of them did what they could to undermine the orders or not implement them. There is one example of a testimony where Arab guards willfully shot their weapons away from Jews who they were ordered to shoot on. Or sometimes there were Arab guards who were especially kind to Jews who were suffering at the hands of torture. And the torture there, in some cases, rivaled the torture of some of the camps in Europe. So we do have these testimonies from some of the Jewish survivors.
You describe Algiers as being the setting for one of the war's most remarkable episodes of Arab solidarity with Jews. What happened there?
Vichy France tried to win as much support among the local Arab population for its policies as it could, and it tried to bribe local Arabs. And one way it tried to bribe them was to invite Arabs to serve as custodians of Jewish property, confiscated property, shops, stores, factories that Vichy took from Jewish property owners. And they offered Arabs the opportunity to run these, and it was make quite a nice, tidy profit. Then one Friday in 1941, all of the mosque preachers in Algiers issued a khutbah, a mosque speech, on the same Friday, in which they said it was forbidden for any believer to take the bribe from Vichy. And the remarkable thing isn't just that the mosque preachers, the imams, all issued that order. The really remarkable thing is that not a single Arab took the bribe. Not a single one broke with the edict. And the Jews of Algiers remembered this. The leaders of the Jewish community said, you know, it wasn't their battle, but still they understood and were fraternal, and they remembered. And I think that is a great story of solidarity at a time of war.
Another story from Algiers is about a Muslim leader who resisted and urged people to resist any efforts to create a Jewish pogrom.
Yes, there were Muslim religious leaders in Algiers in the early 1940s, late 1930s, who, although the Vichy and Nazi anti-Semitism was targeted first toward Jews, they understood that Arabs were only slightly lower on the ladder of peoples that would be the object of that persecution. And if, you know, first the Jews went, targeting the Arabs wouldn't be too far behind. This wasn't widely accepted. There were some Arabs who did welcome the coming of the fascists, but especially among a group of liberal Muslim religious leaders and part of the Algerian nationalist movement, they said, no, we shouldn't let this happen to Jews, because first go the Jews and then go the Arabs.
You write that the most famous of the Arabs who helped save Jews during World War II was Sultan Mohammed V of Morocco. What did he do?
Well, the most important thing that the Sultan of Morocco did was to lend vital moral support to the Jewish community of that country. Morocco was under Vichy control. Vichy wanted to apply the Vichy laws. And one famous episode, the Sultan said in front of Vichy officers and the international diplomats that were at his court that the Jews are all his children. All the people of Morocco are my children, and I don't make any distinction between and among them based on religion. Vichy went ahead and implemented its laws in Morocco, but the Jewish people of Morocco forever remember the Sultan for standing up and not acquiescing himself in the fervor with which Vichy went about its business.
Now, his Tunisian counterpart also helped Jews. What did he do?
Yes, his Tunisian counterpart, Mansif Bey, is less well known because, well, there was a revolution in Tunisia which got rid of the monarchy, and the rulers, the victors, get to write history. And there still is a monarchy in Morocco. And Mansif Bey had a very difficult situation because the Germans actually came to Tunisia, and he had to wrestle with how to keep his country intact, how to deal with the German occupation, and still do what he can to protect Jews. And when he first came to the throne in 42, one of his first acts was to decorate a large number of Jewish personalities to give the message to Vichy and to their German allies that Jews were an integral part of his kingdom. And then he surrounded himself, his principality, he surrounded himself with a court of very liberal people who did wonderful deeds on behalf of individual Jews, warning Jews that the SS was coming to make arrests, helping to exempt Jews from forced labor, individually helping Jews. And this was all under the patronage of Munsif Bey. And the Tunisian ruling family, the royal family, to this day is remembered with great fondness by the Jewish community. And actually, in my research, I went to visit the Grand Rabbi of Tunisia, who lived at the time, he's passed away since, he lived in an apartment right next door to the oldest living heir from the Tunisian royal family. And I knocked on his door, and I was let in, and he explained to me that for the last 50 years, since the overthrow of the monarchy there, that he and his family had been taken care of by Jews. His apartment was paid for by Jews. His son's education was paid for by Jews. And this was a wonderful testament to the memory in which his family was held by the Jewish community of that country.
You also visited the home of Mohamed Chaniq, who was the prime minister of Tunis during the German occupation. What did you find out there?
Well, Mohamed Chaniq was a philo-Semite. Many of his business partners were Jews. Many of his friends were Jews. And there's some really compelling stories that he did what he could to help save Jews during the German occupation. And so At one point, I wanted to find out more about him. And so I gathered together his family, his children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, etc. They all met at the family home. And I went to see them to see if they could provide me more stories, more evidence. And while they were very polite and welcoming, this was the first experience of mine where I found that they were really not interested in learning about the wonderful deeds that their father and grandfather had performed. And I guess I was a bit naive. I had thought that these sorts of exploits, these great humanitarian exploits, would be welcome to learn about. They were very, as I said, very polite, but I'm quite sure that they were pleased when I left, and they were very happy to show me the door.
You think that they weren't that enthusiastic about the idea that their father and grandfather had helped rescue Jews?
Well, one of the phenomena that I've witnessed in the last couple of years as I've gone around talking to various children and grandchildren of these rescuers is a very mixed reaction. And sometimes they're very honest. You know, sometimes children and grandchildren will say, what my grandfather or father did half a century ago was wonderful then, but politics makes it very difficult for me to touch the story now. And this has to do with this very sad reality that somehow over the last 50 years, in many parts of the Middle East, many parts of Arab societies, it became toxic to celebrate stories of Arabs who saved Jews. And even though, you know, the politics, this is before the State of Israel, there's certainly no political implication here, but still the politics has become so toxic that for many of them it's very difficult to embrace, at least in a public way.
Now, one of the really interesting documents you found, you actually got in France from a mosque there. And this is a document that showed that a mosque had provided certificates of Muslim identity to Jews so that Jews could pass as Muslims and not be endangered.
Yes, this is a fascinating story because it occurred right in the heart of Europe, right under the German occupation, when Vichy is control and when the Germans are in Paris. And the story concerns the great mosque of Paris, the foremost Muslim institution in all of Europe. Its head was an Algerian by birth named Si Kadour Ben Gabrit. And there is compelling evidence that Si Kadour Ben Gabrit saved up to 100 Jews in a very clever fashion by providing them with certificates of Muslim identity, false identity papers, birth certificates, marriage certificates, saying that this person is Muslim. And with that, they could evade arrest and deportation. He even went so far in one episode to help save a certain famous Jewish singer, a man by the name of Simon Halali, by inscribing the name of Halali's grandfather on a tombstone in the Muslim cemetery outside Paris, so that when the Germans came for Halali, he was able to say, but wait a minute, look at my grandfather's name on that tombstone. I'm really a Muslim. Halali just died a couple of years ago, and that anecdote was mentioned in all of his obituaries. And when I was in Paris a little more than a year ago, the current rector of the mosque handed me a document from French archives, which showed that the Germans had even brought in his predecessor, Ben Gabrit, and scolded him and warned him, stop providing the assistance that helps so many Jews. So I thought that was pretty compelling evidence.
Robert Satloff is the author of Among the Righteous and the executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, in stores and online at bn.com. From Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we listen back to an interview with Peter Boyle. He died Tuesday at the age of 71. Boyle was described in the New York Times as one of the most successful character actors of his time. And we continue our conversation with Robert Satloff and talk about the Holocaust denial movement. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Satloff, the director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and author of the new book Among the Righteous, Lost Stories from the Holocaust's Long Reach into Arab Lands. It tells the story of Arabs who protected and rescued Jews during World War II after the German Nazis, Italian fascists, and French Vichyists enacted anti-Semitic measures in North Africa. I figure you've been following the coverage of the convention in Iran that challenged whether the Holocaust existed. That convention was held earlier this week. What have your impressions been from what you've read?
Well, it's a pretty sad collection of people that have gathered in Iran. sad because they are the most obscure and fringe people in among European and American Holocaust deniers. They don't even reflect the main thrust of the problem of Holocaust denial in the Middle East today. I mean, those people are truly fringe. I mean, they happen to have an adherent who runs a major state and is very serious about his intent, I think, to implement what he has to say, which is the destruction of Israel. But I think even most Arabs who read this will say, well, you know, that is so far out. That's not what I think. What most people in the Middle East are dominated by ignorance, not, I think, by a deep-seated, well-thought-out hatred and malice. And that's why we need to touch people and try to attack the ignorance. I would like to think that Arabs actually have a Holocaust story that they could tell back to Ahmadinejad, that their own experience, both with perpetrators and with heroes, I think Arab historians have their own experience with the Holocaust, even apart from what happened in Europe, as terrible and as hugely grotesque as that was. But Arab historians can stand up if they want, if they knew this, and they could say, wait a minute, it even happened here. So don't tell me, don't lecture to me about the Holocaust.
You know, you write about two trends in Holocaust denial. One is the trend of, like, it never happened, it's just a lie. Or, you know, it's just a lie to justify the creation of Israel. But then there's what you describe as Holocaust minimization. Well, it's just an exaggeration. Not 6 million. You know, maybe some Jews died, but it certainly wasn't 6 million. Can you talk a little bit about Holocaust minimization as a trend?
Yeah, actually, Terry, I think there's three different categories.
Mm-hmm.
On one end of the spectrum, there's denial. It's a myth. It didn't happen. At the far other end of the spectrum, there's not denial, but there's celebration. Yes, it happened, and it was good. And the only bad thing about it is that Hitler didn't finish the job. You also see this written in some regrettably mainstream newspapers in Arab countries. But the vast amount of people, I think, have the third view, which is relativism or minimization, which is, well, it was nothing special. We don't know actually how many died. Was it 80,000? 600,000, 6 million. This is almost exactly what the president of Syria told Charlie Rose several months ago. I don't know how many died, and it doesn't really matter. This is what the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, wrote his doctoral dissertation on 30 years ago in the Soviet Union when he said, look, the numbers are open to dispute. All of this is really an effort to delegitimize Israel, where if there's nothing uniquely special, if this wasn't the most effective effort to exterminate an entire people in human history, if there's nothing uniquely special about this, then there's no need for a unique remedy, which is how many Arabs view the creation of Israel. And I think that's why Holocaust relativism, the idea that no, we don't need a special word, genocide, a special word that was created just for the Holocaust. We don't need these special words because, okay, bad things happen over time. They've happened before and they'll happen again. But in fact, the world recognizes that the Holocaust was a uniquely depraved moment in human history for which we had to create new words to describe the enormity of the depravity.
You're the director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. How would you describe the goals of your group?
Our group was founded 21 years ago to try to provide a balanced and realistic view of the nature of Middle East politics and how the United States government should try to assert its interests in the Middle East. Now, everyone is trying to grab the mantle of realism these days, but I believe that what we've tried to do for the last 20 years is bring great regional expertise, people who know the languages, society, history, politics, and culture of the Middle East, and try to offer an alternative source of analysis and recommendations for, in a very bipartisan fashion, for the executive branch of government, for the policymaking community in Washington, who are always looking for good ideas and good analysis and good recommendations.
Are you still doing your show on Al-Hurra? Am I saying that right? Yes. And this is Al Hura is an Arabic cable station that's funded by U.S. money.
Satellite.
Okay, satellite. And it's beamed across the Arab world. And I think your show is the only show done by an American. Do I have that right?
Well, from what I understand, I'm the only non-Arab to host an Arabic talk show on Arab satellite television anywhere. Mm-hmm. Al Hura is the U.S. government-funded Arabic satellite television, which goes out to all the Arab countries of the Middle East. And then last August, we started beaming to the Arabic speakers of Europe. It is independent of the government in the sense that, in the same way that Voice of America has a firewall that separates it from, you know, direct intervention by the government. And my talk show is designed to demystify Washington for Arab viewers. It's called Inside Washington, and every week I look at different aspects of politics, personality, and policy in Washington and try to give Arabs a way to access what really makes Washington tick.
How long has Al Hura been on the air?
Al Hura has been on the air for about 3 years. I've been on the air for just over 1 year. We had our celebration about a month ago.
So is this the station that was created after the invasion of Iraq?
This is the station
to improve
that was
our image in the Arab world.
Yeah, I personally don't like that phraseology because I don't think we have an image problem as so much we are fighting an ideological campaign against radical extremism. And I think what we need to try to do through our public diplomacy is to identify, nurture, and support allies in this campaign against radical extremism. But yes, the idea of the station emerged after 9/11, and the Congress and bipartisan support, and the administration was hugely supportive, and it got off the ground, I think, in 2003.
Do you feel like in some ways you're fighting a losing battle trying to make your points on a station that I think is seen in a lot of the Arab world as being American propaganda?
No, not at all, because If you view yourself as vying for the same market as Al Jazeera, then of course you're going to be despondent. It's because there's no way that an American-funded station can compete with the yellow sensationalism of an Al Jazeera. But that's not at least how I view it. Our objective is more the what I would call the PBS market in the Arab world, those thinking people who are looking to understand Washington, who are looking for a liberal alternative, who are looking for a place on their remote control which they can call a home. And that's very different from what most people in the Middle East find on all the other stations. And so I think that, yeah, obviously we need to do better in our ratings, but the key objective is to reach out to those people who are on the front lines, and if we can touch them and have them access us, then I think we're doing a first-class job.
My guest is Robert Satloff, author of Among the Righteous. He's also the executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Satloff, author of Among the Righteous, Lost Stories from the Holocaust's Reach into Arab Lands. He's also the executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. You know, a lot of experts who follow the Arab world say that the war in Iraq has just been an incredible setback for the United States in terms of our image and our diplomacy. Do you agree?
Well, there's no doubt about the war in Iraq being a huge deficit on America's ability to achieve its objectives throughout the Middle East. But I would not take the reality of the war in Iraq, as difficult and as troubling as it is, and be a Cassandra about America's entire standing in this part of the world. Arabs are still want us very much to be engaged for many reasons. Arabs fear a rising Iran. Arabs know that we provide an important security protection against a rising Iran and the Iranian influence that is spreading in many parts of the region. Arabs know that we are still the key broker in helping to achieve an Arab-Israeli peace, and they want us to be engaged. Arabs know that we remain the most powerful external actor throughout the Middle East. And if you go and speak to Arab leaders, informed opinion throughout the Middle East, they are fearful of our departure far more than they're fearful of our continued deep presence in this part of the world.
Just curious, did you support the war in Iraq at the time of the invasion? And do you still think now what you thought then?
Now, I was living in Morocco at the time of the invasion, and so it was a rather unique vantage point in which to see what was going on back here in Washington. I did support the idea of ultimately using military force to overthrow Saddam Hussein and to change the course of that country. In my view, I still think it was the right thing to do. I think the greatest problems occurred after we had achieved that military victory, and I have deep regret about many of the decisions that have occurred since then. I still think that it was the right thing to do.
In spite of everything that's gone wrong and all the setbacks that have resulted?
Well, I mean, you know, as a historian by training, and I know that this is going to be not the easiest thing for many people to swallow, but a historian by training, we're still extremely early in this process. I think that we have dealt ourselves a terrible situation in Iraq, but I think that overall, the idea that Saddam Hussein would not just be in power, but that would be free of sanctions, which was really what the option was back in late 2002 and early 2003, I think that would be an even worse situation. Given a rising Saddam and a rising Iran, I think would have been a much more difficult situation. So I'm quite modest about the benefits, believe me, that we have that have accrued to us in the last couple of years.
I'm sure when you started the process of trying to research how the Holocaust affected Arab lands and what Arabs did to try to protect Jews who were in jeopardy, I'm sure when you started that process, you had some idea of what you were going to find. How does that preconception compare with what you actually found?
It's a very interesting question. I had thought when I first decided to do this that these stories existed, that they were just out there, and all I had to do was really just find them in obscure books and popularize them, just make them more better known. But then pretty soon after I first made this initial decision, I learned that of the 20,000 non-Jews recognized by Yad Vashem, the official memorial to the Holocaust in Israel, the 20,000 non-Jews recognized for rescuing Jews, the righteous, it's the righteous of my title, that none of them were Arabs. There are Muslims. There's Bosnians, Albanians, Turks. There are people from East Asia. There are people from all over the world, but there are no Arabs. And so then that said to me, you know, there's something going on here. There has to be. I mean, the war was fought, at least partially, in these countries. There had to be some. And so at that point on, I just had images in my mind of what these stories would be. And only by really tracking them down and being very fortunate, some of the people rescued tracked me down. Then I was able to piece together these stories. They in many respects were even more wonderful in their humanitarianism than I had originally imagined.
Robert Sattloff, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Robert Sattloff is the author of Among the Righteous and the executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. The clarinetist and soprano saxophonist Kenny DeVern died Tuesday at the age of 71. Tomorrow, we'll remember him and listen back to an interview and performance he recorded on our show. In the meantime, here's a track from his 1997 CD, Breezin' Along. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with the actor Peter Boyle. He died earlier this week. This is Fresh Air. After a long career as a character actor in movies like Joe, The Candidate, Young Frankenstein, Taxi Driver, and Hammett, Peter Boyle became a regular presence in the homes of millions of TV viewers in his role as Ray's father in the sitcom Everybody Loves Raymond. Boyle died Tuesday at the age of 71. He had multiple myeloma and heart disease. We're going to listen back to an interview I recorded with Peter Boyle in 1988 when we talked about several of his films. Why don't we start with your first starring role in Joe, which became the kind of frame of reference for a certain kind of working class bigot of the period.
Joe is a film that was made in 25 years ago, and during the time of the war protests and, in the first years of the Nixon administration. And I didn't realize it until a few months ago, but the movie was made in late 1969, 1970, about this bigoted hard hat kind of guy and children, involved having kids on dope, and he goes crazy and he shoots up a bunch of hippies, blah, blah, blah. But the movie was made and released only 5 weeks after Kent State. And when it was released, it really caught this, the tragedy and craziness of that time.
Why don't we hear a bit of that?
Oh, you're going to play
Brand.
It?
Yeah,
you're
we'll play
kidding.
A clip of that.
This is going to shake me up.
All you got to do is act black and the money rolls in. Set fire to the cities, burn a few buildings, you get paid for it. Throw a few bombs, you get money and jobs. If you can't read, you got a better chance of getting hired. A lot of good my education did me. And your kids, the white kids. Money don't mean nothing to them. Motorcycles, marijuana, $5 records. The dollar ain't worth shit.
So who did you pattern Joe on?
Who did I pattern Joe on? Oh, certain people I knew as I grew up. Uncles, policemen, teachers, certain people of a certain social class.
Did people start to confide their prejudices to you?
Yeah, they come up and say, hey, Joe, you had the right idea about all those hippies. You know what we should do? We should put them in a big boat and take it out to the middle of the ocean and drop a nuclear bomb on it.
And it, well, you know, at any given time in this society, there's any number of people that like would like to murder a certain group of people. So, there was a certain funny kind of reaction to it.
What impact did Joe have on your career?
Well, it sort of started my career, but it also distorted it a little bit. So I kept trying to avoid a stereotype, but the more I did, the more I got into it. So
you got into the stereotype the more you tried to avoid it?
Well, movies are very, people are very, the typecasting goes on forever. And if you do one role and you make an impression in it, that's all they want you to do. It's really true.
Now, let me move on to a very different film, Young Frankenstein.
Did I make you nervous then?
No.
Okay. I thought you were defending the typecasting system.
No.
Young Frankenstein.
Yes.
From a bigot to a monster.
Not well,
such
that's
a
progress.
Simple. Yes, Young Frankenstein.
This is Mel Brooks's horror spoof.
Yes.
And you were the monster.
Yes.
So did you go back and watch the original, study Boris Karloff?
I didn't have to, because I had seen the original when I was about 12 years old, in an era before television, where there was a movie in downtown Philadelphia that used to show old movies. And a friend of mine went down to, and I went down to see the original Frankenstein, and it scared me. And it made such a strong impression on me that I really didn't have to go back and do research, because I patterned my performance on Karloff and made, you know, and did it a certain way. And I wanted to make it like there was somebody inside the monster.
Did you remember the monster's grunts, which, of course, you had to do?
Yes, of course. Yes.
The makeup is actually very funny for the film. Because you could see where the makeup is.
Well, the Young Frankenstein really sort of spoofed the early Frankenstein movies, which were actually the first, among the first sound movies ever made. They were made in 1931, and the lighting and the makeup was very much in the style of the silent movies. It hadn't gotten that sophisticated, so some of the makeup was, you were aware that it was makeup, that was somewhat intentional.
One of the highlights, I think, of Young Frankenstein is when Gene Wilder, who plays Dr. Frankenstein, the scientist, is showing off you, his monster, his creation, to a big audience of scientists. And then you, as he's showing you off, you do a duet with him of Puttin' on the Ritz.
Yes.
In full top hat, white tie and tails.
Mm-hmm. And seven, and shoes that are elevated have soles that are eight inches thick. because that's the part I remember. And I had to tap dance in those.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes or cutaway coat, perfect fits. Dressed up like a million-dollar trooper, trying mighty hard to look like Gary Cooper.
Cooper, Cooper!
You grew up in Philadelphia.
Yes.
And in this city, you were famous as the son of Uncle Pete.
That's true.
The show that your father did that people I know who grew up in Philadelphia remember was called Lunch with Uncle Pete.
Yes.
And why don't you describe what he did on that show?
Well, he would have kids come into the studio, and also this is a time when kids would actually go home from school and have lunch. Or little kids who were at home would have lunch, and he would announce his menu for each day, and he'd have a little lunch, and he'd draw some pictures and tell some stories, talk to the kids in the studio, and show various old movies. A lot of times he showed our gang comedies, and he also went through another period where he showed a lot of Hopalong Cassidy.
How old were you when he was doing Lunch with Uncle Pete?
When he was doing all that, I was not a little kid anymore. I was really like a guy. When all this went on, I was like in high school and then out of high school and in college.
Was it exciting to have a father on TV? Was it ever
what was really sometimes it would, I don't remember too much. Sometimes it'd be embarrassing. Only you get recognized everywhere, and then. But what was exciting for me was he would bring me down to, especially in the early days, because everything was live on television, there was an incredible excitement, and he would bring me down to the studio, and I would sit and watch them rehearse and watch them shoot these shows. And since there's no tape and there's no error, there's no repeating anything, everything was very exciting. And then also sometimes there'd be fascinating guests or, you know, just people would pass through the station. But they would go from studio to studio. I remember seeing a TV crew wrap a show, rip off their microphones, and run down the hall and into the next studio to, you know, to fire up the cameras for the next show. So I enjoyed watching all of that, the production of it, and seeing him do it and hanging out with him. It was really exciting.
Did that ever give you the bug to perform?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe. I think it did. Yeah, it did. Also, my dad, you know, we grew up in Philadelphia. My dad was an avid movie buff and theater buff, and he took me to the theater a lot.
That's great.
So we saw a lot of plays, a lot of musicals, but also a lot of plays that used to, when there was more of a Philadelphia, was more a tryout town.
Peter Boyle, recorded in 1988. He died Tuesday at the age of 71. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chilog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university offering more than 20 doctoral specializations online at capella.edu. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember the late clarinetist and soprano saxophonist Kenny DeVerne and listen back to a performance and interview he recorded on our show. DeVerne died Tuesday. Also, the songwriting team behind the Broadway musical Avenue Q, Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks. Join us for the next Fresh Air.